Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The winter sport of ice climbing is not for the faint-hearted. Imagine scaling a wall of ice high above frozen terrain, perhaps tethered to and dependent on your fellow climbers. It's an experience that those who climb find incomparable, and those who don't may find mysterious and scary. In this hour, we're going to remove some of the mystery surrounding this extreme sport with a few guests who know a lot about it, and we want to hear from you. If you have questions or comments, a story to tell about ice climbing, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, but it would be most fun to hear you on our phone lines. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And joining in this hour for a conversation about ice climbing, Michael Wacher is a guide with Cathedral Mountain Guides and a wilderness first responder, as well as a board member of New Hampshire's Mountain Rescue Service. He collaborated with Laura Waterman on the second edition of the classic history of climbing in the northeastern U.S., Yankee Rock and Ice. He lives in Madison. And Micah Burhart is a professional climber, part-time guide, author, and conservation entrepreneur. As founder and director of Legato, she works to protect the world's most threatened mountain ecosystems and empower people who call them home. She lives in Jackson with her husband, also a climber, and their twins. And Micah is an AMGA-certified ice and rock guide and a two-term member of the AMGA board. Thank you both very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
And I just want to let you know where I am coming from. Like, I am very much not an outdoorsy person. I will take long walks with the dog. That's the extent of my walking. I'm almost ashamed to say I haven't even been on a hike in like a decade. I'm so sorry. But I'm coming at this with a lot of curiosity, and I hope our listeners will too. So if you meet someone like me, right, and they've heard about ice climbing and they're like, what is that? I don't really know what it is. Micah, how do you respond to that question?
What I tell them is it's a way to be in the winter environment and to go explore it in a 360-degree canvas. Because the thing about ice climbing is that you're not just climbing a plane of ice. You're using your body to kick and swing at that ice with ice tools and crampons on it. And then that winter environment becomes alive. It's no longer static. The worst thing for me would be to have winter and not actually be able to get outside and enjoy it. And ice climbing gives you this other way to do it. I grew up as a ski racer. Ice climbing was sort of a natural extension of that to me. And it's a way to take risks, but also manage those risks and get the intense focus that you can have when you're doing what's called an extreme sport, and then also have the joy that it gives you when you've completed something like that.
And what about you, Michael?
Well, I think especially in New England, where we have traditionally dark, cold winters, it's a way to get excited about, as Micah said, being outside. And these ice climbs, a lot of them are so ephemeral, and they come in for a week, a year, and they need exact conditions to form. So you're really getting excited and you're wondering, okay, when can I go out next? And is this ice climb going to be in? Is it not going to be in? So it's a great way to spend a winter that might otherwise be a little gloomy.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing you can get outside, you can experience winter, make the landscape more dynamic in months that are quite cold and sort of inhospitable. But what does it do emotionally for you? I mean, is it a thrill? Is it to scare yourself a little bit? Is it to just get up super high and get a great, taking a nice view? What is it?
I think for me, ice climbing is interesting and fun movement that you might not otherwise do in an amazing setting. And we have a lot of it here in New Hampshire. I think risk is obviously part of it. But as Micah said, it's more for me, at least, about managing that risk than it is about taking the risk, if that makes sense.
So managing the risk. It's not about like taking silly risks and putting your life at stake, but you know, also getting out there and swinging and feeling nature in a new way. Micah?
Yeah, and I would add that there's the focus that you have when you're ice climbing is unlike anything else. And really the focus when you're climbing, like you're not thinking about your grocery list. I'm not thinking about whether my twins slept well the night before. I'm there and I'm in the moment. And I think we're all looking for things like that, especially more and more in this day and age. And there's nothing that focuses me more than getting out ice climbing. So that's really why I do it, and to push myself and, you know, to try something that's new and challenging, but also for the purity of the experience. So it's really not about, oh, this is hard and I need to achieve it. It's about like being able to be in tune with myself and in tune with nature and have challenge and then come to the other side of it.
How similar is it to something we've heard about, I think, more often, just standard rock climbing? Yeah. Is it basically the same thing but with ice?
It is and it isn't, Peter. It is basically the same thing, that a lot of the systems are the same. So how you use a rope, how you set up anchors, how you make sure you have redundancy, how you climb with a partner. But it's totally different because it's frozen ice. And inevitably, you're climbing a medium that, as Michael said, is ephemeral. So you are breaking that ice in order to climb it. So you're swinging your pick in to create a placement. You're displacing ice. You're, you know, judging how strong it is by what it sounds like, what it feels like, what it looks like. And rock climbing, you're touching your fingers to the rock. And you're putting your, you know, you have a very sort of thin shoe on that is touching the rock on your feet. And ice climbing, you're further away. You have your crampons on and they're distancing you from the ice. So it's a really different thing. They don't necessarily translate exactly side to side. A lot of times as a guide, you'll have people who are rock climbers and then they want to learn how to ice climb. And it's much easier than if you take someone who's never been a climber. But there is a transition for them to make between the mediums. And you have cold. I mean, we're dealing in a cold environment. So
you're bundled up when you're up there.
You're bundled up. Yeah. And that becomes part of how you manage your experience. It's like, how do I stay warm enough? I always talk to people who are like, I can't go ice climbing, I'm cold. And it's like, well, if you're cold when you're ice climbing, you've already made some bad choices. So how do you set yourself up for success to generate warmth and then keep that warmth throughout the day?
I see. Okay, so quick terminology check. Crampons, are those the shoes with the spikes on the bottom?
Crampons are what you put on your boots that have the spikes on the bottom.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, and so ice climbing, is it only good for like a couple of months out of the year, like really cold months, Michael?
It depends on the year, and actually the melting and refreezing is what forms an ice climb. If you have that bitter, deep cold, it's actually horrible for the ice because it locks up. We say an ice climb's locked up and it becomes really brittle. And once you have more moisture flowing, a snow melt or, you know, waterfalls or any type of moisture, obviously we have a lot of that in New Hampshire, that freeze-thaw cycle will grow and create ice climbs. And so depending on where you're climbing, you can sort of start predicting when these ice climbs are going to form. But oftentimes, you can ice climb in New Hampshire from, you know, early November, even October, all the way into April. So it depends on the year. Winters are getting a little shorter. And so this winter, you know, this week is a perfect example of it's not doing great things to the ice because it's too warm. But, yeah, we're able to climb a lot of the year in New Hampshire.
I see. Okay. And you mentioned, Micah, that you're changing the face of whatever you're climbing when you climb it because you're cutting holes in it. Now, is it true that if you're pursuing a path, you could destroy it for the person coming up behind you? Or is it like if you know a particular route and you're like, oh, too many people have climbed this, there's too many pits and divots, it's kind of weakened? Or is it okay?
That's a great question. And I like how you say pits and divots. That's a good way of like, if you get up to a piece of ice that's never been climbed that season, that it's not had a climber on it, then you have to make your way first. And so you are actually figuring out where to swing your tools, where to kick your crampons, and you're making the first purchases in the ice. If you get to a climb that's really popular, say a climb called Dracula and Frankenstein up in Crawford Notch.
Those are great names.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Just the whole litany. If you get up there this time of year, you're going to see evidence of a lot of people having climbed it. And in fact, them going before you makes it easier because you're now, instead of like swinging into planar ice, you're swinging into more of a modulated ice that receives a pick a little bit better. So it can, it, you know, does it go all the way to making it dangerous? Well, it depends on how thin that ice is and what the medium is. You know, kind of what Michael was saying about, I mean, I moved to New Hampshire because of ice climbing and because of the way the seasonality happens. It's not just winter lockdown. We have the variations. But the cool thing about New Hampshire is you can be an elite climber and just have tons of amazing ice to climb because of that variation. But you can also be a beginning climber and have really consistent ice that you can climb all winter. So you have both. And I think that's a really unique thing. And I lived in Colorado before, and very few people like leave Colorado once they sort of arrived in the outdoor world to live in the Mecca. But for me, I thought, man, the ice climbing is so much better in New Hampshire. I'd much rather be here and have a winter here for ice.
Oh, that's interesting. Michael, is New Hampshire kind of known for the ice climbing terrain here?
Absolutely. And I also moved in 2008 to New Hampshire to pursue ice climbing.
From where?
Also from Colorado.
Wow, Colorado not faring pretty well here.
I went to college, and we're probably the two people who have done that.
So it's just the temperature is right, the shape of the ice is correct.
Yeah, and it's all, you know, we have this plethora of other amazing winter activities that are, if you live, especially in northern New Hampshire, 20 minutes away from your doorstep. To have world-class ice climbs that close, we're quite spoiled. And I moved here thinking that, okay, I'll spend one season climbing all of the classic ice climbs, and I haven't left, and I haven't climbed them all, and there's just still so much more to do.
So you haven't climbed them all, and you would likely revisit some of the ones you've already done. And
yeah, it's really fun to see. Unlike a rock climb, ice climbs form differently, or they're different from day to day. So even if you've done a climb before, you know, the next time you do it, it could be a completely different beast, so to speak.
Listeners, we're talking all about ice climbing today, and we'd love to hear your stories, your experiences. Have you tried it in a couple of different states and found New Hampshire either superior or lacking? We'd love to know. 1-800-892-6477. We'd also love to hear your stories about how you got into it, what you love about it. Tell us your experience. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. We got a story from Annie in Saxons River, Vermont. She says, when I was 16 years old during a climbing course in the Cascades of Washington State, we were at 6,000 feet on Liberty Peak. Pause to say that my palms are getting sweaty just hearing that detail. But anyway, continue with Annie's story. 6,000 feet on Liberty Peak on the first day of a 5-day camping and climbing trip. We just set up our base camp and were on an ice wall learning how to use crampons and ice picks. Suddenly someone yelled and we turned to see our tents with all of our equipment for the entire trip lifted up by a massive squall that came through. This is June. We spent the rest of the day retrieving our things and managed to save all but one of the tents. The remainder of the trip was cozy. Wow. So it sound like a familiar story to you guys? Have you heard something like that before?
No, I can't say I've never lost a bunch of stuff during a gust of wind, that's for sure.
Well, do you use tents as well? I mean, that, we haven't talked about that yet. Do you climb up there with stuff and stay there overnight?
Not as often in New Hampshire, but other places like Alaska or Patagonia is the example I was thinking of where our tent blew away and we lost everything. We had to go back down.
Oh, no.
But yeah, no, that's once you start thinking about doing these climbs and over multiple days, the climbs are shorter in New Hampshire, but they're absolutely great training for a place like Alaska. And starting to make a bivouac where you're sleeping on the climb is adds another element of challenge to it. And it's more about managing that warmth and being comfortable, as Micah was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's some of these lessons, they're hard to learn unless you've actually experienced them. But yeah.
Micah, have you done that too? Gone up with a tent and stayed overnight?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, climbing around, you can climb around the world. And it's one of the things that attracted me to climbing. I loved the exploration of it, but also where it could take me. And early on in my climbing career, I was really into mountaineering and actually spent a lot of time in the Cascades, like the story that was just shared. And it was fantastic to be able to put all the technical systems together, but then also to be in the wilderness and to be so far removed. So whether it's there, whether it's Ecuador, Nepal, Patagonia, you name it, or now these days I do a lot of rock climbing, especially in Africa and Mozambique, Ethiopia, Namibia. And, you know, just it can give you this way to understand the world on a vertical plane, but then also understand the context of all those mountains and all those resources. And it's great. So and as Michael said, New Hampshire is a great training ground for that. Like you have to be really, really scrappy to climb here. And if you get good at climbing here, you can take that. It's real mountain climbing. It's not fabricated climbing like you have in a place like Ouray, Colorado. We're really not trying to ding Colorado, but Ouray, Colorado, they have this great resource where they, you know, they've sort of redirect this river into this gorge and you can go and ice climb there. And you can also do a lot of other mixed climbing. And here it's always mountain appropriate, but the access is just out of this world. And that's what really makes a difference.
You said fabricated?
Yeah. So So they'll basically like reroute a river in pipes and then let the water come out. And then they create just this gorge full. It's called Ure. And they create a gorge full of ice climbs. And it's this great resource because people can go there. They can learn to ice climb. They can challenge themselves. But that ice isn't forming naturally. So the ice also behaves a little bit differently.
Like the equivalent of a ski mountain creating snow?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just to keep up the skiing analogy, because you mentioned that you both mentioned that it's training. Like there's good training grounds here in New Hampshire. So does that mean like the black diamond equivalent of ice
absolutely.
Are elsewhere?
No.
Or are they here?
Well, you know, Peter, it really depends on when you're talking about scale. So as Michael said, we don't have climbs that are as long as you'd have in Alaska here, anywhere near it. But what we do have is like hyper difficult technical climbs that are shorter. So you can train your skill set on something that would be the equivalent of a black diamond. But, you know, when then you extrapolate it over the life of, you know, a multiple day climb in the mountains, it's going to pan out differently, if that makes sense.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Emily in Concord. Emily, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love the exchange. Micah referred to ways to stay warm. And my little bit of experience with rock climbing is that there's not really, for me, aerobic activity. And so I would very much like to hear what those ways are.
Thank you, Emily. Micah?
Absolutely, Emily. So I specialize in staying warm when climbing, when ice climbing. And the way to do it is you almost have to make your own aerobic activity. So the thing that happens that really hoses people and makes it so that it doesn't go well is that they stop moving. And when you're belaying, when you're not the person climbing, you sort of turn inward in the shell of yourself. And what you really need to be doing is moving your arms and moving your legs. And if I'm ever in the cold and when I'm belaying, if you looked at me, I look like sort of this, like I look really busy. I'm doing little squats. I'm moving my arms. I'm, you know, flexing different muscles and then relaxing them to keep that blood flowing. So that's one of the prime things you do. It's also generating warmth when you approach a climb. So when you're hiking and then maintaining that warmth. So not overheating, making sure you're taking your layers off is a big, it's a big thing for beginners. They tend to not want to stop. They tend to want to like feel that warmth and get sweaty, but then they're cold and clammy and then they're fighting against that. So it starts the moment you leave the car, making sure you're taking care of yourself on the approach and then, you know, adding your layers and doing great systems with your gloves. I always put my gloves down deep into my jacket, several layers deep, so they're warm. So when I take them out and put them on, I have warm hands. I like to tell people, especially when I'm guiding them, that like ice climbing is a full-time job. And so this, what we're going to do today, like there are no breaks. And if you can think of it that way and always be making sure you're taking care of yourself, then you can get through the day warm and to the end of the day warm.
Do you have to buy a lot of special warm clothing for an ice climb?
It's not necessarily different than what you need skiing. However, these days, skiing and snowboarding pants have a lot of flare on the bottom, and you're going to kick those. You're probably going to shred them a little bit when you have crampons on.
Don't want anything to get in your way.
Yeah, exactly. You want kind of a more of like a tapered skinny leg going on. But in terms of clothing-wise, I would say the biggest difference is having several different sets of gloves and mittens, and that makes the biggest difference because as you start climbing harder, you want thinner mittens and thinner gloves. Otherwise, you end up getting very, very like tired forearms. So you probably need like two or three more sets of mittens and gloves than you would skiing.
So, Michael, how expensive is it to get into ice climbing? Do you have to load up on a lot of expensive gear or can you rent gear? How is it?
These days, there are a lot of great, the Mount Washington Valley Ice Fest, there are a lot of sort of festivals for beginners to get into it where the companies will come and rent out demo gear. And so you can sort of try on different things. Unfortunately, if it's something that you're interested in doing over the long haul, it is an investment. It's far more of an investment than rock climbing or running or something like that. But just the nature of winter sports is that they are all sort of gear intensive. You know, skiing, you have to have certain equipment to go skiing. So it is an initial cost. As Michael was saying, the staying warm, I would recommend spending a lot of money on good boots, good footwear. Staying comfortable is such a bigger part of ice climbing than it is for rock climbing. But it is an expensive sport.
Let's talk to Brian in Bartlett. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
What's on your mind, Brian?
First, hi, Micah. I'm the Brian that built your house.
Hey, Brian.
Couple of things. One would be, the mitigation of risk. A lot of people think, you know, ice climbing is absolutely insane because of the risks involved. But I like to equate it to driving your car. If you're driving your car correctly within your abilities, within what the vehicle is capable of, it's remarkably safe. I find ice climbing to be the same way. And the second thing would be the reason I got into ice climbing was an extension of hiking and then rock climbing and then into ice climbing as basically progressing up the scale. But it ice climbing makes everything else I do in the outdoors more enjoyable. It ups my confidence level to the point where I know I can handle situations that might be a little bit sketchy for your run-of-the-mill hiker.
So if you can handle ice climbing, you can handle anything.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thank you very much. Really appreciate the call. So Brian had a comment about ice climbing safety compared to driving a car. Is that a comparable thing in your mind?
Yeah. First, Brian, thanks for building my house. Our family loves it.
What a small town this state is.
We enjoy it very much. And yeah, you know, I really appreciate what Brian said about it's not just the same as anyone getting in a car. It's about how you choose to use that vehicle, how you're making choices about what type of climb you're going on. Is it commensurate with your experience? Are you using the equipment correctly? And if you can keep all of that within a certain margin, then you can have a great day and you can have a safe day. And then you can also choose to play with that margin if you want to have more challenge, if you want to be on the edge, if you want to push yourself and get to something that's technically harder, get yourself to the next level. And then you can also fall back and be in that comfort zone. And, you know, both Michael and I work as guides, and one of, you know, your principal role as a guide is introducing people to climbing or taking long-term climbers out. I was out with a guy who started did the first ascent of a climb called Dropline back in Frankenstein the year I was born in 1976, the second ascent of it. And, you know, I took him up it the other day because he wanted to have a guide, which is something he never would have considered back in 1976 when he was at White Mountain School and hitchhiking his way to Crawford Notch to go and do that climb, which is way harder core than I would have been. And, you know, it's like making that choice that felt like a good risk benefit to him then. And then now saying, how can I up my safety? And that's one of the things that we can do as guides.
Listeners, we are reveling in the joy that is ice climbing today on The Exchange. And we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call if you have a story about an adventure you've had on a New Hampshire mountain or another mountain in another state. We'd love to hear comparisons, good or bad. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. More on ice climbing in just a minute. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. We are talking about the sport of ice climbing. New Hampshire is known internationally for ice climbing, thanks to our state's weather, which makes for some great ice. Listeners, are you an ice climber? Why do you love the sport? If you're learning about it, what do you want to know about it? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. With us today, Micah Burhart, professional climber, part-time guide, and author and conservation entrepreneur, and Michael Wacher, a guide with Cathedral Mountain Guides and a wilderness first responder, as well as a board member of New Hampshire's Mountain Rescue Service. Before the break, we got a call from someone comparing ice climbing to driving a car, meaning if you drive responsibly and plan and be smart about it, it's going to be just about as safe as driving a car. I want to ask you a little bit about that analogy, because you can be a safe driver and do everything you need to do, and there's some other idiot on the road who's going to make your life miserable. Maybe they'll plow into you when you are being perfectly responsible. Is it possible for your safety to be dependent on someone else while you are doing a climb? And how vulnerable are you to the good behavior and smart decisions of others while you're climbing? Maybe we'll start with you, Michael.
I think that's a personal choice. Climbing underneath somebody in a sport where you are constantly knocking things off a cliff is never that great of an idea. And these days ice climbing has become more popular. It's a little more crowded. The thing that I always want to sort of drive home is that talented, experienced ice climbers on an objective that's difficult for them will turn around a lot of the time. And that's a huge part of that mitigating risk is simply, you know, sometimes it could be, oh, this feels a little off, or obviously there's going to be this hanging dagger that when the sun hits it, it'll fall down the cliff. And sort of taking that big picture and saying, today's not the day is a huge part of this sport, and it's far larger a component than in rock climbing. And we call it objective hazard, something that's out of your control that could ruin your day.
So subjective hazard, not as big a thing as objective hazard.
Subjective hazard, yeah, would be your own decision-making versus something like an avalanche hazard or terrain above that might fall down on some of these bigger ice climbs is something to consider.
Agree, Micah?
I definitely agree with Michael. And I think to the, you know, what you bring up about driving and other people's choices impacting you, that also comes to how you choose a climb and how close you're going to choose other people, not climbing underneath people. I think if there's something that more experienced ice climbers can really help newer ice climbers understand is to like stick by that cardinal rule. And then also to understand, you know, when you're choosing your partners, are you going out with people who you feel like are safe, who can make the kind of decisions that you need them to make to have your safety be paramount? And so, you know, that depends on if you're getting into ice climbing with mentors, and can you vet them and be sure that you're going to be learning the best practices? Are you going to go the guiding route, making sure that you're working with guides that you feel like, you know, have that experience level that you want to trust? And then also being able to look at each other sometimes and say, hey, Michael and I might go climbing one day and one of us didn't sleep so well the day before, and just be like, hey, I need to just ratchet back the risk today because I'm not feeling up to it. And all those things make it a better choice.
We got this note from Eric Thatcher. He says he's coach of the Holderness School ice climbing team. He wrote in today to say, we're listening to this exchange on our commute to the cliffs for our morning ice climbing practice.
Awesome.
That alone says a lot about the accessibility of ice climbing in this state. So Eric, putting a plug for how accessible it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Eric.
Cool.
Hi, Holderness.
Thanks very much for your note, Eric. And let's talk to Dave in North Conway. Dave, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to bring into the conversation a little bit about Mountain Rescue Service. I think your listeners would be interested to know that in the state of New Hampshire, all of the technical rescues we have are done by volunteers. And we do work under the New Hampshire State Fish and Game and are covered under their workman's comp insurance. But virtually all of the equipment and all the expertise that is involved in these rescues is done strictly by volunteers.
Wow.
And the infrastructure that we have for that is really dependent on people like Micah and Michael being able to make a living and an income mountain guiding and doing the other things that they do in this area, which allows them to live here, make a living doing that, and be a good enough expertise to then do the volunteer rescues on their own when they're needed.
Well, Dave, thanks very much. That's an important point to mention, and maybe you might be too modest to mention it yourselves. But are your activities as paid guides sort of subsidizing your volunteer work as rescuers?
The majority of the Mountain Rescue Service, which is the technical rescue service in New Hampshire, anytime there is a technical rescue on a cliff, we are called. Often by fish and game. It depends on the jurisdiction. But yeah, I would say that, you know, we act as volunteers and we're happy to give back to that community. I think that the sentiment, and I don't want to speak for everybody on the team, is that it easily could be you out there. And so we're quite happy to go out and do what we can.
I think, you know, to Dave's point about the fact that we are making a living here and that we've chosen to live in New Hampshire and northern New Hampshire really speaks to the economic impact that ice climbing and the outdoor industry has in New Hampshire. And it's massive. And one of the great things that's happened over the past 10 years is we've actually been able to start quantifying that. So, you know, there are numbers out there that, you know, in New Hampshire alone, state and local tax revenue is $528 billion in the outdoor industry.
Mm-hmm.
And you have wages and salaries at $2.6 billion. And like for us, I mean, that's one of the reasons that we both choose to live there, but we can live there. And so when you tie those things together, I mean, then you actually have this really knitted fabric. And I think that's at the heart of New Hampshire and the heart of the way New Hampshire understands the outdoors and is passionate about the outdoors is that we can have, you know, businesses that will support and then give back to things like Mountain Rescue.
Your calls are welcome on ice climbing. Any questions you may have or stories you want to tell, 1-800-892-6477. Christopher wrote on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, are there any man-made ice climbing walls in New Hampshire? And he follows up, is there a way to make your own?
There have certainly been attempts over the years, but I'm not sure that there are any official man-made ice climbing walls in New Hampshire. And the reason probably is that we have so much darn ice to begin with I don't think it's really been seriously considered.
No need to make it because we have plenty in abundance naturally. Okay. I can't. How would you make it yourself?
You know, there are places in the Midwest now, too, that they're doing it on the sides of silos. It's pretty cool where they don't have access to that verticality and the relief. So they've decided
like grain silos?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Yep. And then be able to have a little ice park there for the, you know, 2.5 months a year where it's cold enough to maintain it. So you're just redirecting water, similar to what we talked about in
Uruguay. What do they do? Like run a garden hose up through the
top? Yeah.
And...
Yeah.
Ingenuity. All right. What else are you going to do with those silos in the off season, I guess, right? Okay. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Aaliyah on Facebook wrote in to say, in the topic of gender and climbing, do you think it's important to differentiate male versus female first ascents? Why do you think statistically there are fewer women who take the sharp end in both ice and rock climbing? Is it as simple as women being more risk averse? And sharp end, is that lead?
Okay. Nice, Peter. So you're getting your lingo.
Credit to Jessica Hunt, producer, hooking me up with all the right information. So yeah, the question about gender. Lots to unpack there. Micah, would you like to give it a shot?
Absolutely. So I think it's absolutely important to signify if it's a female first ascent or a male first ascent. And, you know, I started climbing in the 90s when I got to be a serious ice climber when I was about 19. And I was one of the few women who was ice climbing at that point. And I was darn proud to be a young woman who was a strong ice climber. And I remember at one point, you know, taking the climbing party I was with, no one else felt like they could go lead this climb called Bridalveil Falls in outside of Telluride, Colorado. And I led these two guys who were each 10 years older than I was up a three-pitch climb that at that point was and still is a test piece. And I felt different being a young woman and pulling that off. And now, you know, I'm 43 years old. I'm a mom. And I being able to, like, come back from twin pregnancy and climb at the level that I climb at is really important to me. And not just as a climber, but as a mom and as a woman who's gone through, like, the incredible transformation that was for my body to carry and feed those kids. So I think we have to have it as part of the conversation because, you know, I think to Aaliyah's question about why are there fewer women who are actually on the sharp end who are leading. And I think it's because we haven't had the role models out there because we're not having the conversation. You know, back to my friend who I went climbing with the other day who, you know, started climbing in the 70s. I said, well, were there women? He's like, no, they were too smart to suffer like that. And there's something to be said that, like, that might not have sounded as appealing to people in the 70s. And it wasn't open to women at that point. There wasn't necessarily like, come on, come join us. And now it's our job. And this in our generation to make sure that we're bringing women to the table and we're bringing women to the vertical plane so we get out and climb together.
So you started in the 90s.
Yep.
How has it changed for women between then and now?
Wow. Honestly, it's exploded in terms of how many climbers there are, but still at the top of level of women who are ice climbing and who are leading and who are, you know, like side by side and putting up some of the hardest routes and completing some of the hardest routes, it's pretty similar. I would say proportionally that has not exploded as much. There are many more women and men who are trying ice climbing, but fewer women who are sticking with it long enough to be at, I would say, the top of that game. And there's many more than there were in the 90s, but I would say that we still need to have a big explosion there.
Michael, you're nodding, so you're agreeing with their sentiments.
Absolutely.
There. Yeah, okay. So tell me a little bit about the history of this sport. Micah, you said in the 70s this was a thing. Is that about when it started as an organized, you know, almost sort of cousin of rock climbing, or does it go back farther than that?
It goes back further than that, but I would say the 70s were a big heyday in New Hampshire for ice climbing, and a lot of it comes down to gear, and when, you know, we had gear that allowed us to climb more vertical ice. I mean, back what you used to do was cut steps and be able to use tools, so your ice tools are the picks that you have in your hand, and they've changed, and they've just, like, had a big engineering change that happened in the past 15 years, but there were some big changes that happened in the 70s that really opened up more technical climbing, and that's when there was a big emergence. And Michael is, a local expert on the history of climbing, so I'm going to give him.
Yeah, Michael, feel free to let it rip.
I think at some point somebody figured out that if you had two ice axes in your hands, you could do a lot better than if you had one, and that sort of came from Scotland in the 1960s, where they had similar terrain, and in the Alps they were more interested in climbing snow slopes and chopping steps. And we had done a little bit of that in New England. Pinnacle Gully on Mount Washington is our classic easy climb. It was climbed, I think, in 1922, a long, long time ago by two college students at the time. But the sort of revolution, as we call it, of actually having technical, shorter ice tools that you could swing into frozen ice as opposed to snow and climb vertically really happened in the United States starting in I'd say 1971. And New Hampshire was a huge part of that. We had a route called the Black Dyke, which is sort of our classic difficult ice climb that's on Cannon Cliff right above 93 in Franconia Notch. And it was sort of hailed as the last great problem of New England ice climbing. And this college kid named John Bouchard went up and soloed it for this sort of legendary first ascent, and nobody believed him, and sort of the pantheon had to go back and say, oh, you have to confirm this ascent. So he actually did the second ascent as well with three other climbers to prove that he had done it. And so we kind of have this awesome origin story of the first sort of technical ice climbing in New England.
Does New Hampshire play a significant role in the history of the sport?
Absolutely.
How would you describe that role?
Well, the area in New England was one of the first places that the technical ice tools from Scotland were being brought over by a guy named Devon Chouinard. And he began blacksmithing his own ice axes and sort of selling them out of his car, I think, to people. And he later founded Patagonia and founded the company Black Diamond, so two really major brands now. But at the time, you know, it was sort of this fledgling garage operation. But people started buying these tools, and with that renewed equipment came this absolute vaulting of standards. And all of a sudden, people were able to climb. Today, we would probably not take those risks, and you know, ice screws were really difficult to place and everything. But vertical ice, and so sort of some of the classic routes that we still consider tricky were done with really antiquated gear in the 1970s, and it's really impressive to think about.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Dan in Colebrook. Dan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
When I was over at Willoughby, I was ice fishing. I'm not a climber, but Lake Willoughby in Vermont, and they were climbing down the ice face. This is about 500 feet, 400 feet, something like that, my guess is. It turns like 65 degrees, and these guys were climbing down pieces, and right next to them were ice chunks the size of cars falling off. And I'm like, you know, we were all scared for him. You know, well, there was like three or four of them. We were all scared for them guys. You know, and they shouldn't be climbing in that stuff, should they?
Good question.
Sounds like climbing down instead of climbing up is a good call.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's hard to tell exactly what the scenario was, but I will tell you, you know, the warm weather is a big concern with ice climbing. And inherently, one of the things we've talked about already is what makes New Hampshire ice so good is that you have the variability in the seasons. But even in the 12 years that I have lived here, I've seen marked change, and that's all about climate change. So right now, there are estimates that New England is more impacted for its winter than anywhere else in the U.S. So we've had 3.5 degrees warmer in the winter in New England versus the rest of the world has an average increase of 1.5 degrees. That's a huge difference. There's something like the Hubbard Brook Research Station, who's been doing this research for 7 years, here in New Hampshire, has shown that there's close to a month less time with snow on the ground. You have way more winter rain. So when you talk about all this, and then was it Dan who just called in, who was ice fishing on Lake Willoughby, you have these beautiful ice climbs that are up that are just solid and an amazing climb. And then you get this rapid warm up, and that's when they start falling. And so him saying, you know, there are car sized chunks of ice coming down, I don't doubt that, especially if it was during a really warm day and you have this rain that can run behind the ice on the rock. It can warm up and then it can let loose some of this.
So how often would chunks that big be falling in a climb that you would do?
So I would not get up on a climb that was doing that. I would try my darndest not to make that happen. That doesn't mean that you can sometimes misread the conditions, but that's what, you know, having a big picture on what your objective and subjective risks are really important. And then knowing the history of the temperature over the past week and saying, wow, there's that really big warm-up like yesterday and today. Like, these are not days that would make me want to go ice climbing tomorrow on something on big ice like on Willoughby, where you can actually have a big consequence there. But I really do think that it brings up like this this conversation of it's almost like as ice climbers, we have to be more responsible because we're seeing the climate change happen like right in front of us. And we need to start thinking of it differently. You used to be able to reliably climb any ice in February. And now February is behaving like March.
Wow. Okay. We get this comment from Mike in Goffstown who says, nothing as pretty as Cannon Cliff in January in the early morning. Cannon Cliff, you familiar with how
Absolutely.
Cannon Cliff looks in early January?
Yeah.
How would you describe it?
Well, it's on a good day, it's plastered in ice, and it usually looks pretty cold to me, but there are some amazing climbs up there. And one of the aesthetically cool things about climbing on Cannon is that it is this sort of iconic-looking cliff that to actually eke your way to the top of it in the wintertime, it's quite an achievement for anybody. It's a really incredible thing to be able to do. And that probably everybody in New England remembers the first time they climbed Cannon Cliff. You know, it's a special thing.
Well, we'd love to hear about your first time climbing any particular cliff, or maybe just a time that was significant to you, something that really made you feel very good, maybe something that scared you, and maybe you got out of a tricky situation. Tell us how you did it. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email of your story, exchange@nhpr.org. Your host, consummate couch potato, is almost convinced to give it a try himself. We'll find out how I feel in the next 15 minutes about ice climbing. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
From the seacoast to the Upper Valley, Monadnock to the Great North Woods, NHPR covers the stories that impact your community to help you stay connected to what's happening in every corner of the state. I'm Annie Ropeek, a reporter here at NHPR, and when you give $10 a month as a sustainer, you'll help support a vital resource that is statewide, regional, and deeply New Hampshire. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and right now we're taking a look at the sport of ice climbing with Michael Wacher, a guide with Cathedral Mountain Guides and a wilderness first responder, as well as a board member of New Hampshire's Mountain Rescue Service and the co-author of Yankee Rock and Ice, A Classic History of Climbing in the Northeast, and Micah Burhart, a professional climber, part-time guide, author, and conservation entrepreneur. She's also an AMGA-certified ice and rock guide and a two-term member of the AMGA board. Last chance, listeners, for you to weigh in with your ice climbing story. Tell us why you love it. If you're learning about it for the first time today, what questions do you still have? Give us a call now. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. One of the fun things about anything you're learning for the first time is the lingo. And there's one bit of lingo. I don't know what this is. I'm going to go out on a limb and ask you about this. What are the screaming barfies? Who wants to take that?
The screaming barfies are an experience unlike any other, and they are absolutely the worst part of ice climbing. And the phenomenon occurs when you are sitting still and getting really, really cold, belaying, or it's early in the morning, and so all of your blood sort of shunts to your core, and so you have no more feeling in your fingers. And then when you start climbing, right, you're ramping up the activity. And so the blood comes back and you have this horrible sensation of regaining feeling in your hands. And for a second, you wish they were still numb. And the ice climbers call them the screaming barfies because they make you want to scream and barf at the same time.
Not actual barfing, just make you want to. Okay.
One would hope.
one would hope. All right. So this seems like a very physical thing. Obviously, you're climbing, you're belaying, you're bouncing off the cliffs. To what extent should you train for it before you go out? Like, do you have to sort of at least have a passing acquaintance with the gym or some kind of physical activity, or do you have to really strengthen your muscles before you get out there?
If you're a good ice climber, you're using your legs a lot more than you're using your arm. And that's the same thing for rock climbing. I would say that if you want to get into ice climbing and you have access to a rock gym, it's a wonderful thing to do because you're going to get used to the systems and you're going to get your body moving and climbing. Just general cardio fitness and comfort being in the cold. So if you're an ice fishing fan, spending time outside so your body's more used to it, all those things can help you. That being said, you could get up off the couch, Peter, and you could go ice climbing with me and we'd have a really good day.
So what do I have to do? Do I have to start doing cardio right now to sort
no,
of
we
prepare
could go
for
it? We could go tomorrow.
Yeah.
Nice try.
You are removing all the excuses.
Yeah, this afternoon.
Oh,
exactly.
No. Oh, no. So, okay. So, so it's a couple months out of the year, 2 or 3 months at best, right?
More than that, I would say. Reliably, more like 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. So what do you do in the off season, both of you, to sort of stay ready for it when the time comes to start climbing
rock
again?
Rock climb.
You do rock climbing?
Yeah. Rock climb, hike. Cross-country ski. As soon as the ice climbing's not as good, a lot of times the skiing's good for another month. And yeah, just keep doing all those things outside. But rock climbing keeps you in shape.
Okay. We've been talking a little bit about New Hampshire exceptionalism, too. Does the quality of the granite matter at all?
Oh, yeah.
It does?
Yeah, and it's actually extremely rare in the lower 48 to have such good ice climbs and have them overlap with really good granite. And obviously, when you can get rock anchors and rock protection, and it's really solid. It's an awesome feeling for a climber. We have one of the only cliffs, or some of the only cliffs where the rock and ice climbing have an equal history. And so it's really difficult sometimes that we don't really get along. And when you're ice climbing on these granite cliffs, you can scratch the granite. So people have to be really careful. But it's a very rare thing to have such good rock with ice climbing. And that's part of what makes New Hampshire so awesome.
Why wouldn't you want to scratch the granite? Rock climbers put holes in the rock all the time, right?
Well, they used to. And now we say it's sort of clean climbing. And so it's more of an aesthetic thing. When you're climbing a classic rock pitch, you don't want these little crampon, cat scratches all over the place.
But, I see. Yeah. Okay. To what extent is this done professionally? Are there competitions? Are there world rankings for skill levels? Tell us about that.
So ice climbing is done competitively. There are World Cup ice climbing competitions all around the world.
World Cup.
Mm-hmm. And it's really, really skyrocketed, I would say, in the past dozen years. That being said, that's a very small sector of ice climbing. And what that actually looks like is really gymnastic movement, a lot more like the way rock climbing is done in competition. So you're doing some fabricated holds that you're piecing together with big reaches and overhanging and big moves. It's not necessarily the climbing that you would be doing when you're your everyday ice climber here in New England. That being said, what is this done professionally? For me, I've been a professional climber for 20 years, and that means that I'm sponsored by wonderful companies. Patagonia is a company I've worked with quite some time, and it's not because I'm on the competition circuit. It's because of the climbing I do in I would say the real climbing world. So not in these fabricated competition scenarios, but really the climbing that I do in mountains and in rock and ice cliffs around the world. And that's really where most professional climbers will sit in that sector versus the few that are doing the competition climbing.
So what factors are they judged on for competition?
When they're doing that, so it's about, there's different things. There's speed and there's difficulty. So, it can just be a route is really difficult and who can actually make it the furthest. They also have speed comps. So you're actually on a slightly easier route and who can get there the fastest. So there's different ways of being able to judge that.
And you've never competed?
I have actually in Urea a number of years ago, but I don't compete anymore.
How'd you do?
I didn't do that great. It's not the right stress feature for me. Some people who compete really well, might have grown up in climbing, and there's so many youth programs right now for rock climbing and at gyms and them getting into competitive climbing. And when I grew up in Minnesota, there were no gyms like that. So I didn't have it as my background. I was a ski racer, and I think to this day I could probably ski some gates pretty well competitively, but it was not meant to be, Peter.
Okay. What about you, Michael? Have you competed?
Oh, yeah. Locally, but never internationally.
Never.
I'm not good enough on that steep stuff. And I think part of, for me, the unquantifiable nature of ice climbing is what draws me to it. So competition and sort of the safer, more gymnastic stuff hasn't interested me as much as sort of going out there and searching for climbs that are rarely in some hollow in northern New Hampshire somewhere.
For you, the competition is not the point. The point is going out there and having the experience for its own sake, not to go out and be some kind of objectively qualified winner.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you prefer to go out alone or do you prefer to go with groups?
Well, always with a partner.
Always with a partner.
Absolutely. And, I like the sport is a great way to sort of catch up with friends that you only see in the wintertime. You know, you have ice climbing friends and you get to rekindle these relationships with them. So it is a great way to spend time with close friends, or if you're guiding, meet somebody totally new who's being introduced to the sport.
Same for you?
Definitely. My husband and I climb together a lot, and it's how we met is ice climbing, and that's still continues to be a big part of our relationship. And I love getting out guiding with new people and sometimes doing groups. Like I took a group from the Tuck Business School ice climbing 2 weekends ago, and it was awesome. That was all their first exposure to it. So it's nice to have the mix of it.
We've got a listener who is asking about sliding falls. Like how do you stop yourself from continuing to slide, I guess, on a slope as opposed to just a straight up and down cliff? And also, what about helmets?
Always.
Always have a helmet?
Always for the helmet.
That's an easy question. Okay. Now, how about stop? Like, let's say you're sliding down. You just start like...
So I'm guessing that's a question about self-arresting, because if you were ice climbing and it's steep enough and they're using a rope, then the rope is going to stop you. But if you don't have a rope on and you are sliding down a slope, then you want to make sure that you have the mountaineering skill set, which is self-arresting, using an ice axe and actually leveraging your body so that you're facing belly down in the snow or ice and digging that axe in. And, you know, that really comes with practice and commitment and knowing how to do that before you're in terrain and in a problem where you need to have it. So a lot of times when you teach people how to do mountaineering, you know, you take them through a progression where you're actually practicing self-arresting before you're in a place where you're going to need it. And actually, if you've gotten to the point where you need it, you've made a mistake.
Okay.
Right. Taking the time to assess the terrain and saying, okay, well, we should probably take the rope out and start belaying and using something besides the knowledge of self-arrest to keep ourselves safe.
Okay. And another question do they share ice they've found or keep it a secret? And if so, if you do share, how is the info shared?
Certainly not going to say that on the air.
Come on.
Really? You don't share your secret? Well, you say they're so transient, right? Like they're here and then, you know, the weather could change and your cool ice face might change.
Well, it's interesting. I think social media has drastically changed the game of how people find out about ice climbing. And there's far more people now who can sort of check online and say, oh, some such and such climb is in. And that can create sort of this bottleneck at the base of certain climbs if somebody's posted about it. So.
I see. So if you find something, you'll get what you want out of it. And then maybe if you're feeling generous, you will say something publicly
right, maybe,
about it. Like if you know you're done with it.
Yeah, right. Wow. It's usually after you're done with it.
Certain element of selfishness. But hey, if you find it, right? You have a right to enjoy it first.
Right, yeah.
There's something I've heard about with rock climbing, something called Kodak courage, right? Like mm-hmm. if you, like people who just will do things that they maybe won't normally do just because they want to take a photo.
Mm.
Is that a thing in ice climbing as well? People going maybe a little farther than they should, a little riskier than they should, just to take a photo for social media?
So the way I've always understand Kodak courage is when people are taking photos of you versus you wanting to go take a photo of something. It's more like if a professional photographer is shooting you when you're climbing, that you might be more inspired to take a risk, to run out, to have less gear, to just perform at a different level. And I would say, having worked with professional photographers extensively over the past 2 decades, that it's a real thing. Like if you're having someone else and you're sort of there to showcase how you do at something, it can mess with your brain. But ultimately, to be a good climber and to be a good lifelong climber, you better be making good choices. And so you need to be able to, like, basically push that down and make sure that you're being safe and that that's what's paramount.
We should mention that you have amazing photos on Instagram and Facebook, Micah. So we should put a link to that at nhpr.org so folks can check out these amazing images. We got this note from Mitch in Bedford who said, I've climbed since I was a kid, but ice climbing was the first thing that truly clicked for me. I love the movement, and I love the natural puzzle of it all. A climb can be different day to day and may or may not exist week to week. It's a fun challenge and a wonderful connection to the natural world around me. We might have to wrap up soon, but I did want to get you both to sort of share a story, if you have it, of a meaningful climb that you took once, whether it just made you feel really good, maybe it was risky and you get out of that situation, or just something that sticks in your mind as something that really makes you feel good about participating in the sport. Maybe we'll start with you, Michael.
Well, I think the first year I lived in New Hampshire, I did a climb that was sort of this legendary climb that forms very rarely. It's on a south-facing cliff, and I remember sort of being a little over my head, but pulling it together and climbing this route on the south face of Frankenstein with a good friend, and, you know, we topped out back to, you know, when you're ice climbing in New England, it's always the security of the trees. You're trying to get to the trees and then get off the climb, and we topped out just as it got dark, and it just sort of clicked, and that was the moment where I really realized that I'm going to stay here and be an ice climber. I love this. There's this certain smallness to this place that is really attractive to me about ice climbing, especially in New Hampshire.
What about you, Micah?
It's funny, I was thinking a similar moment to actually the first day I ice climbed in New Hampshire. I showed up, I was out here for the Mount Washington Valley Ice Fest. They brought me out, my first book had just come out, and I woke up the next morning and I just had someone's name on a sticky note and just like call them to climb, and went climbing with this guy named Doug Madera. And Doug, you know, we went climbing and he just kept handing me the screws and, you know, being like, I'll give you a belay. And I just had this totally magical day of ice climbing and just kept thinking, how did I not know this was here? Like, wow, like this is such a resource. And I was so blown away. And, you know, driving back home from Crawford, at that point it wasn't home, but driving back to North Conway and just looking everywhere and seeing the ice and thinking, wow, like this is a place that I need to pay attention to.
Well, those are fantastic stories. Thank you very much for being part of this hour. You know, if I can start off small, and that's possible, right? You can start small.
You're on the air, and you're committed. Right?
I mean, next winter,
yeah, but like, we can start small.
But yeah, starting small, I think would be well within my comfort zone, and if I, of course, had a good guide, right? Because good guides help beginners sort of become folks like you, right?
Absolutely. Keep you safe and make you enjoy it. And that means you had a good day.
Wonderful.
So we're in. You're committed.
Yeah, there, here we go.
I'm committing. There you go. So I'll catch you winter 2020, 2021. That'll be what it is. Micah Burthart, professional climber, part-time guide, author and conservation entrepreneur, and Michael Weichert, a guide with Cathedral Mountain Guides and a wilderness first responder, as well as a board member of New Hampshire's Mountain Rescue Service. Thank you both very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
It was fantastic.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And listeners, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The engineer is Dan Colgan. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.